Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for having me. For those coming from around the state and other states, welcome to Syracuse. For those of you in Syracuse, thanks for coming up the hill and welcome to Syracuse University. And for those from Syracuse University, I promise I'll get back on that email really soon. I want to talk tonight a little bit about, I work here and they never let me on the stage except for graduation, and they never let me talk at graduation for obvious reasons. So if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to give you my speech now. The bad, the good, and the great. Where did that come from? School of Information Studies, the iSchool, has a policy. And that policy goes like this. If you're going to come give a speech, and that's really great, we bring really great people in, you have to give us a tweetable description of your speech. We need it in 140 characters that we can send it out. And it's sort of a litmus test, because if you say, well, whatever I say is so important, I could never curtail it to 140 characters, you don't get to come. So I sent out a tweet the other day, a couple months ago actually, and got some rather interesting reactions, and it went like this. Bad libraries build collections, good libraries build services, great libraries build communities. To which I instantaneously got like 3,000 tweets back going, collections are fine and it's okay. And so we can build collections, and I said, that's not the point. So let me now take a little bit more than 140 characters to flesh that one out for you. Bad libraries build collections. That does not mean that good libraries don't build collections and great libraries don't build collections. That's not the point. The point is the focus. Where do you pay attention? Where do you spend your time? Where do you spend your resources? Where do you spend your thinking? Where do you put your value? The sort of classic view, or what I call the bad library view, is you view the collection as your primary activity. You focus your value, you focus what you do, you focus your resource, your people, everything around this idea of a collection. You worry about coverage. You worry about shelf listings. You close the building every 6 months so that you can go through and make sure just how many books did faculty steal that semester. And we have sort of a grand tradition about thinking about the collection. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you look at someone who is truly, you know, an idiot savant in collections, can walk through stacks and tell things that's like Sherlock Holmes-like. I was walking through a library with the head of acquisitions for the University of Maryland system, and this was not in Maryland, and she sort of stopped, plucked a book off, went and said, oh, this hasn't been circulated since about 1972. And I'm, stupid me, expecting to see the card with a stamp on the back of it. And no, this is a punch card system. And those punch card systems got phased out here, and then we get replaced with this, and now the RFID tag's over here. I mean, there are like 50 different ways of doing inventory about this book that had not been checked out since 1972. We don't do that anymore, right? This is not cool and hep librarianship. We understand that it's not about the stuff, that it's not about, this is, you know, saying things about librarianship is not about books. It's like saying things like air is important to breathe. This is not a radical new idea. Because we know where our focus is on the user, right? It's on the consumer, it's on the customer. And I'm going to argue that actually that's a problem too, because my job is to come up with problems. This is the good libraries, right? Good libraries build services, of which they realize a collection is only one of those services, right? If no one uses it, it's not a service. If we don't let people get at it, it's an archive. Or worse, if we don't let anyone get at it, it's a vault, right? And we have this idea that it's a service. We found this in the digital world, though it's very applicable to the physical world. We worked on something called the National Science Digital Library. And the National Science Digital Library, the National Science Foundation, was going to give out lots and lots of money, so we were there. And they gave it out in two chunks. One chunk was the collection chunk, and one chunk was the services chunk. And so they would go to the collections folks and they'd say, here's a lot of money, yay, make a collection. And what would they do? They would begin digitizing, they would begin creating, I mean, really amazing stuff, watching things like caffeine molecules rotating in 3D and Confucius texts and really amazing stuff. And then they would go to the services folks and they'd say, all right, there's the stuff. build services like search, like 3D visualization, like the ability to annotate, the ability to put them together. And the services people go, yes, we're at it. We've got our software ready to go. They'd walk over to the collections people, and the collections, and they'd say, give us your collections. And the collections people would hand them a URL. And they'd say, well, this is odd. And they'd go to the URL, and they would find a search function. And they would find a browsing web page. And they would find all of these services that the service folks didn't build and, frankly, didn't know what to do with. Because what we learned in that millisecond is that when you put things together, that's a service. When you allow people to have access to it, that's a service. When you alphabetize them, organize them, catalog them, categorize them, search them, index them, put them in the catalog, they're services. And we learned that the reason that they're services is not just because we like doing it for other people, but because they come with a sense of definition around who we intend to use them. Right? We catalog things in English because we assume the population using it is going to be speaking English. That means we've made one leap beyond simply what's there to what we want that interaction to be. Right? It's a little esoteric, but with me so far? So we've built all these kinds of services. So the collection is one service. Get at the stuff. But we've built other ones. Search. Annotation. We built the ability to find it and come up with an APA citation so you don't even have to read the abstract anymore as an undergraduate. You can cite it right off the website. A great revolution for every 18-year-old on the planet. I ran an ERIC clearinghouse. We knew we did the index and we were done. Really, the document didn't have to exist after that point. So, all right, that's good, right? Bad is we deal with the stuff, we only are comfortable with stuff, we don't let anyone near our stuff. Good is we think about who's going to use it, why they're going to use it, how they can use it better. Now, I talked about this as user-based. Now, this is where I get to brag a little bit about my home turf. The idea of user-based systems, of user perspectives, Syracuse University, the School of Information Studies, had a lot to do with that. Bob Taylor and some Nyland and Durbin, they all spent a lot of time thinking about users. And it's important to think about the users. And you build a system, you do user-based, right? User experience, user interface, user design, all this other stuff. The problem is we've learned that over time, it's not enough. Right? That they're not just users. Right? So I've sort of said, okay, don't focus there. Now I've told you don't focus here. Where the hell do I focus, Dave? What's going on? I mean, certainly it's not those librarians in the middle. We know that's bad. Right? We never worry about ourselves first. So what do we worry about? Well, what we need to realize is that person is not a user. How many of you have the device of the day? iPhone, Android, iPad, iWhatever? Okay? Are you a user of this device? That's my question. This is the interactive portion of the evening. I realize I'm standing between you and a kegger in the hall later. But work with me. Are you a user of your smartphone? Yes. All right. Anyone have one on them that they're willing to share to the world? We'll pick on Roy. Roy, what do you got? iPhone 4S. And tell me, on that iPhone 4S, do you maybe accidentally, kind of, sort of, maybe your kids put on and have a game?
Oh, all the time.
All the time. Like?
I play cards.
Cards. There's an app called Cards. Work with me, Roy. These people are getting bored already. This is as close as I get to a magic trick. I'm an Adolf guy myself. It didn't come on there, right? You put it on there. You deliberately took the time to put it on there. Not only did you put it on there, but you probably even moved it to a screen or two. That is not a user. At this point, that phone, when you looked at this phone and said, first of all, we don't make calls with these damn things anymore, right? Did you see that the average time spent on phone calls went from 3 minutes to a little over 1 minute in the past 5 years, right? We don't call anyone on these things, right? So what you did is when you said, well, this is my telecommunications experience, you defined that it's going to call, it's going to surf the web, and it's going to do card games. At that point, you are actually designing and orchestrating your mobile experience. You're not simple, and remember, if you take the Apple day when Steve Jobs, all hail, came out with the first iPhone, and people said, well, can we put software on it? And he was like, oh, no. You are not going to sully my phone with your crappy card game. Right? It wasn't until 2 years later into the iPhone that they came up with the idea of maybe there's an app here. And suddenly they realized maybe there's a couple $1 billion in selling Angry Birds here, that suddenly Steve Jobs goes, well, we've designed the app world. Right? This idea of a user as someone who simply takes and consumes, it doesn't exist. Think about for a moment, if you're designing your library service for someone who comes into your library and consumes, an information consumer, right? It sounds like a wild beast foraging through the library stacks. Abstract statistics. Right? We're the Agora, we're the Commons. I mean, we're not like, you know, the prairie fields fattening up the undergraduate calves, but that's, you know, they're not users. They're designers. They've got more to them than simply consumption. If we treat them as someone that simply consumes things and walks away, we have underserved them. Joan Fry Williams put this much more elegantly than I ever could. She says, we need to stop thinking of libraries as grocery stores and start thinking of them as kitchens. We need to stop thinking of them as a place where people get everything they need, then they walk away to do whatever they're going to do. And think of it as a place where they're actually doing stuff, and usually in a very social environment. Right? I don't know about you, but when I have parties, it's everyone ends up in the kitchen. Right? So, if they're not users, and they're not consumers, and I hate the word patron because the last time I did an 18th century oil painting on commission was a long time ago, what are they? Well, I asked this question once and someone said, I don't know. People? Yes! Right? They consume. Yes, they do. We all consume. I mean, we've all sat back and watched a movie and 2 hours later going, well, that sucked. And you're like, 2 hours later you say that? Anyway, we all consume. Right? But we also produce. We write things. We blog. We tweet. We do the Twitter down the tubes. Whatever it is. Right? We knit. We do all of these things, particularly in an academic context. The academic context is geared around production. Production. Production of papers and assignments and research and training and teaching and workforce. And it's about production. They work. They play. They have aspirations as well as problems. And they do it within the context of a community. Oftentimes, we've been so geared around this concept of the user that we don't realize that we've become rather myopic about us to one individual. Think about it. Reference is built around one-on-one conversations. Why? Well, let's be really honest. We can go through the whole privacy and that, and that's important, but a lot of it was because how many librarians did we have versus how many were coming in? Right? We set up one-on-one systems, and then we backfilled. We deal with this idea that they're everyone's one-off, but they're part of a community. They're coming in. Right? How many people work the desk when it's the English assignment? Yeah, right? Where you have every answer to every English paper ever written that the professor told you behind the desk, and the student comes in and says, I've got to do a paper. And you just take that wonderful moment when you go, a paper? On what, pray tell? And then you milk it. Right? You're going to finally show them what the damn library's for. Oh, you're not going to get an A if you don't talk to me. What is paper about? You need a resource? Does it have to be peer-reviewed? You don't know what peer-reviewed is. Let me tell you about peer-reviewed. And then just finally it's like, here. Right? This idea that they're part of a society, they're there for a reason, right? The faculty member felt it was important to send them. They're there because they want to get an A. They're there because their friend said, did you know what they'll do for you over there? Did you know where the cheapest color printing is? This idea that they're part of a community that has norms, that plays into it as well, that there's peer pressure going on. So what I want to just talk to you about this evening are two of these. I want to talk about what I think are the two most problematic words up there. consumes and problems. And I want to talk to you because I think that as a profession in academic libraries, but librarianship in general, we have adopted these two concepts way too wholeheartedly. That we have structured ourselves around something that is, in the very long term, very problematic. And so I want to walk you through that idea. And the first one around consumption comes from the notion of, is your institution a lending institution or is it a sharing institution? Now, you may think of these as synonyms. What's the difference between lending and sharing? And the quick example that I have, stealing Joan Fry Williams' obsession with food, because clearly I don't have one, is think about you're going to throw a dinner party. Now, there's two ways of throwing a dinner party. You're in the middle of one, right? This model of the dinner party is, well, how many people are coming? What are we going to serve? How many things? What's it going to cost us? We go, we get the materials, we produce it, we prepare it, we serve it. Now, what would happen if, for some bizarre reason, three times the number of people that we expected showed up tonight? Right? If someone heard about the kegger and thought this was it, what would you do? That's a lending model, right? You're sort of lending people food. You have a limited amount of resources. As more people consume those resources, you have fewer to give. It's either going to cost you more because you've got to go to the store, you're going to start cutting portions in half, whatever it is. The more people show up, the smaller the pool is to share. So far, so good? Now, I want you to think about another model, and that's the potluck. Now, the potluck is the more people come and everyone brings a dish, the more there is to share. Except, of course, everyone always brings queso dip and soda. But the more queso dip there is. I mean, there's so much stuff that by the end of the day, you're just sitting there going, oh, the chili was great. Maybe you want to take that home now, right? Now, there's still resources involved. You still got to put out the tables. You still got to see who's in there and invite. But the point of that, that's a sharing model. So put this in this mode. If we have a resource, a little lonely book, and we have one person who wants to get at that book, life is easy. But the more people who come in a lending model, the more scarce that resource becomes. We've all seen this in hold lists. Now, the public librarians instantly jump up and go, that damn 50 Shades of Grey, right? I don't know. In academic libraries, is there an equivalent? It's my book, isn't it? Yeah, no. Yeah, my book in 50 Shades of Grey. Now you want to read it. Yeah. There's a whole appendices on handcuffs. Anyway. Roy's doing the content tomorrow. I'm purely the entertainment. The point of this is if you have a lending model, which means you put aside an allocation, a budget allocation, whatever it is, you buy a journal, you buy a number of seats, whatever it is, the more successful you are, the more your marketing works, the more powerful you are in delivering the message, the more better evangelist you are, the fewer resources you have to share. Death by success. I was just reminded of the early days of virtual reference. Virtual reference when we were going to go online and let people ask us questions. And we were talking with services like Ask a Scientist and Ask a Mad Scientist was great. My favorite was Ask the Amish, which was an email service to ask the Amish a question. How do you turn butter? How do you read this email? Anyway, it was run by the Mennonite Center like across the field. But the other one was Ask a Locksmith, because every time I heard that, I was like, I'm in a room, and I can't get out. But all the libraries were like, oh, no, we can't actually tell people that we'll answer their questions online. What did they ask us? Right? And now we're to the point where we flip the coin, and we're like, please, God, ask us a question. Do you know how much I'm paying Question Point a year? So we know this, right? So what we try and do, in fact, why we're here and why this specific group is here, is we go to try and build another sharing model into it, so we build consortia, right? The old joke, what do you call three librarians at a bar? A consortium, right? And so we try and say, all right, well, if we don't have it, then you have it, and we'll share it, et cetera. And that works well if you assume that there's spare bandwidth there. But we know that many of those institutions have just as many people pulling on those limited resources as well. I'm not even going to get into the licensing hell that we live in, but stick with me for a minute. This is a sharing model, ultimately, and the sharing model means that you limit your own success. This is a lending model. You limit your own success. If you have the collection and you're loaning out your stuff, the more people who want your stuff, the less you have to lend out. If we move to a sharing world, we need to look at those little mannequins, the little penguins up there, and we need to say, you know what? They got stuff too. In fact, if they're faculty, they got our stuff too. They have their own materials and resources that they're willing to share. So a man walks in, this is not a joke, even though it sounds like a setup. A man walks into the library. A man walks into the Ann Arbor District Library, and he's talking to Eli Nyberger, who's their head of technology there. And he says, you know how I can go online, I can go to this catalog thing and I can find out if you have a book? He goes, yes, I did that, yes. He says, well, you know how I can find out if you have it at one of the other branches? Yes. He goes, why can't I find out if I got it in my house? He goes, not only, and he goes, because I'm perfectly willing to share it. If I've got it on my shelf, I'm perfectly willing. If you put in a request tomorrow, I'll drop it off so they can have it. Now, in a lending model, that makes no sense. It's not our stuff. We'd have to catalog it. By God, we'd have to wrap it in plastic. Right? But if you're in a sharing mode, it makes perfect sense. Why not? I mean, think about the faculty that are out there. I mean, the joke is, yes, I have 5 books that I have to return. If you've been waiting for Dewey, the irresistible reformer or whatever, that's me, right? But the truth is, I got lots of other stuff, too. I get so much crap in the mail, you can have whatever you want. But I can share this. And the point is, I don't just have books in there. I've got pictures. I've got maps. I've got GIS data. I've got simulations. I mean, if I'm teaching one of my favorite libraries, I don't know if anyone's here from SUNY OCC, they've got body parts. Yeah, dead cats and stuff, because they have an anatomy, right, and physiology stuff. So they loan you an arm. I think that's great. Right? You can have mine if you would like. Anyway, but they've got resources, they've got assets, they've got things. Why can't we share those as well? What we begin to move into is instead of looking at the library as this limited resource that we're constantly struggling to make less limited, but in a zero-sum game, if we begin to look at the library as not the houser of all the stuff, but as a platform for sharing amongst the academy, life changes. So sure, they can still come and get our stuff. But they can also go through our platform to get the stuff of other folks. And this is what's most important. They can go through this same platform to get to each other. To begin to talk to each other. One of the big buzzwords is interdisciplinary, and we need to break down disciplinary boundaries, and by God, we need to get rid of you siloed old professor types. There is no better position in the world than the library to help interdisciplinary settings. We talk to these folks on a regular basis, and if we don't, we should talk to these people on a regular basis. And we should say, you know, so-and-so is also working on that project, and here's something you haven't thought about, and why in the hell is this article on reserve for the School of Information Studies and Anthropology? That's an interesting connection. What's going on there? We can begin connecting people. So I'm going to give you one example of the library as a platform, and I'm going to choose, if I can, the sort of most classic limited thing in the world, which is the catalog. Right? Now, I have railed against catalogs before, but I think I know how to fix them now. Now, we think of the catalog as an inventory system. Someone needs stuff. They come to the catalog and they find stuff. They find books. But no, Dave, we're hep, we're cool. We're with the Twitter these days. They can find other stuff, too. They can find recordings and pictures and things like that. But I want you to think about it for a minute. That's sort of this lending model again. Our stuff, they can find our stuff. What if we take the catalog and think of it as a platform for sharing? So what's in the catalog? Well, we still have content pointing to our archives and our e-books and our materials and our digitized collections. We have our bibliographic data. It's still there. We have links. But now what we begin to do is we can begin to add other things. So actually, we worked with Polaris on a project where we said, what if we allowed the community, and I use the community as a very broad term, not just public, but the community of a institution, a college, a university, as a community, they can build their own profiles. So one of the things that I don't know if you do, but many colleges, you go through they maintain sort of the Facebook, the early Facebook, not the IPO from hell Facebook, where you can go in, you can say, well, this is David Lankus, and this is his research, and all these other things, right? So I can put this profile in and say, this is me, this is my materials, links to resources. I can go in there, but I can also then add events. So I can say, by the way, I'll be speaking next Tuesday night at this time, at this place, right? So we can keep this kind of material, and from that, we could then push out materials such as the community calendar, right? How many people have a community calendar at their college? Yeah. How many people find it really useful? Oh, whoops. Right? Because it's like, I put out, you put out, that school puts out. Who knows what's happening? We can now push out simple web presence. So now I can have my own profile page. We can push out things like virtual branches. So we could embed the best, awesome, cool databases in the actual website of the department. Right? How many times do we have to go through the fact that if you have a license for 500 databases, everyone only cares about two of them, but no one cares about the same tool? Right? So what do? We'll put it alphabetically. No, that sucks. We'll put it in our display. No, that sucks. Right? And so we don't know. We keep shuffling the deck chairs on the Titanic until hopefully somehow Jenga, and we get the perfect organization of 500 overlapping databases with multiple interfaces that no one can understand. What if instead we said, which databases do you care about? These three. Fine, they're on your website. When you go, your students go, your faculty go, your staff go to your website, they find their resources right there. They find the books published right there. And by the way, since I'm putting this profile in, would you know the thing that really ticks me off the most? I'm at a research university. You would think that the primary function of a research university is, and I'm just going to pick a random word here, research. It is easier for my provost and my chancellor to know the status of my health care than to know what I published last week, to know what I published last year, to know what I published in my entire life since tenure. They know really damn well what I did at tenure, right? Does that bother anyone else, the fact that our intellectual input just sort of fizzles around the world? We talk about scholarly communication, and we yell at Elsevier for charging us too much, and they do. But at the same time, we're just sort of opening the doors and going, I'm sure impact will happen. Send it out. Okay. Well, if we have this kind of material in this, if this is all being kept within the catalog, as it were, what else could we do? Well, imagine for a moment that one of those events could be a course. I'm going to offer a course July this to August this. With me so far? I'm going slow. Well, what is a course? A course is an event that's in the catalog. A course is offered by a person that's in the catalog. A course points to content that's in the catalog and materials that are in the catalog and links in the catalog. In fact, all a course is a sort of really specialized bibliographic record. Now, we can add other tools to it. We can add discussion boards, and we can add Meebos, and we can add turn-ins, and we can do all this other stuff. But what I want you to think about for a moment is think about your online strategy, your distance education strategy for your academy. Let me guess. We bought Blackboard. We installed Sakai. We got Moodle. That person builds it in that little silo, and our faculty hate it. Because it doesn't really matter what it is. The faculty will hate it because it's not a whiteboard and them. And so we build this separate infrastructure. Oh, we got to worry about backups. We got to worry about updates. We got to worry about whether it's current or not. Meanwhile, what are you doing in the library? You're building a technology infrastructure to maintain content that needs backups and maintenance and infrastructure. So rather than going and building a separate silo, why aren't you guys the learning management system for the university? Not only that, but when the faculty go to add the content and they find it's not there, they add it. Then we've really got them. Because now all those damn papers we were trying to add to our institutional repository by begging and pleading, they give it to us themselves. Right? This idea that suddenly we can do open courses, we can share with alumni, we can do continuing education development, and the core of it is the public access catalog, but not because it's a catalog, but because it's a platform that allows us to share. And then we dump the stuff into an institutional repository that actually matters. Let's face it, right now our institutional repositories look a lot like morgues with basic Dublin core wrapped around them. Right? It's like, I'm looking for a paper. Let me pull out that slab. Yep, that one didn't get in a journal. We can put that in there. We put that material in there, and suddenly, e-reserves. Duh. You want to worry about copyright compliance? It's right there. You want to worry about creating new material? It's right there. You want to worry about an archive over time? It's right there. And it's at the place where the professionals who understand about information organization, maintenance, archiving, its impact, how it brings together new additional resources they may never have thought about, are right there. That's what we can begin doing if we begin shifting our thinking of the library as a place and of something that lends out this limited collection that has consumers in it to looking at the library as a platform for innovation. Now let me then take, if I may, that sort of deals with the consumer problem, which is they're not consumers. You're not consumers. They're not consumers. You're fully integrated people and professionals in control of your own lives and environment and learning. And so are the people you serve. Oftentimes, libraries, we've adopted so much from retail that we try to make things frictionless. Right? I don't know if that word's entered into your talk. Easy, simple. It used to be Yahoo-like, and then it became Google-like. But it all comes down to so people don't have to think about stuff. Right? And to be truthful, we have a long way to go on that, right? They searched the catalog, they found the record, they clicked the record, it took them to another search page for the database, they clicked in the database, they found the material, they had to go through the proxy server to get it, they downloaded it, they finally had it, and they shared it with everyone they knew. That sucks. But at the same time, the greatest attribute that we can do as people engaged in the scholarly pursuit is to have people think about consumption. Think about what they're doing. The point is not to make it easy to get a student a peer-reviewed article. The point is for them to understand what peer review means and why it's important in scholarly communication. The focus of the library should not be, and this is Joan Bechtel in 1989, the focus of an academic library should not be its collections and its resources. It should be scholarly communication and making it more efficient and effective. We are teaching students not how to use the library. We're teaching students how to be critical thinkers and scholars. And oftentimes that involves friction. Learning is hard. If it's not hard, you're not learning. I mean, they did like real specific studies. I love this torture study. They worked with high schoolers and they gave them worksheets. And one set of worksheets they gave them all in a beautiful, nice designed font. And the other one they gave them in like the ugliest sort of horrible multiple fonts they could find that was hard to read. And then they tested them periodically and they found that the things that were harder to read, where they had to work to decipher and read the code, they retained and remembered more. The hardest, best class you ever had, right? It's not the easiest class that you don't remember going to. Right? How many times, we have students, I love students who come back and they say, oh, that management class I hated, damn, I needed it, right? We run into this. So our pursuit is not to make excellent consumers of frictionless consumption, right? That's what Amazon's trying to do. That's what Google's trying to do. What they're trying to do is make it easy to buy stuff from them and not think about it. The academy, and I don't care if you're at the community college level, the vocational level, the college teaching level, the research level, higher education in this country is not about the preparation of factory workers and drones. It is of scholars and critical thinkers that push forward our society. That's what we're doing, and it's hard. And we need to bring people into that process. Problems. We need to ditch the deficit model. The deficit model is where we look at the community as a bag of problems with ugly shoes. Right? Where we look at people and we say, oh, these undergraduates don't get it. They just look at the abstracts, they don't cite materials, they don't know this, they don't know that, they don't know this. And they're going to fail. Oh, these professors don't get it. They're using resources that are out of date. They don't know how to do this. They don't know how to do this. They don't know. And we gear ourselves around the problems of our communities. We do it through offering instruction. We do it in trying to offer workshops. We do it in begging them to at least take a look at the new resources. Right? But we focus on what they can't do. instead of focusing on what they can do, their aspirations, their dreams. My example of this is always tenure. So I went up for tenure. It was lovely. And then I had a friend a year later go up for tenure. And I said, call the library. Just tell them you're going up for tenure. Just see what they say. If you come down for an hour, or you send your graduate student down for an hour, we can show them what you need to do to find all your citations. Now, what that phrase, what that statement says to me is the following. One, we'll show you, but we won't do it for you because you're not important enough. Two, bibliographic searching of information is something that we can teach someone in an hour. Anyone else spend 2 years on a graduate degree around some of those topics? Can we truly encapsulate all the complexity of searching for that material, impact and such, and in an hour we can show a graduate student? In an hour we can show a graduate student how to go through Scopus. Scopus ain't it, right? We need to find out what it means, what's happening. So what if instead of doing that, waiting for people to ask us, we know who's coming up for tenure, we know they're terrified, we know that they're desperate for help. Why don't we show up on the first day of school and go, hi, I'm Dave. I'll be your tenure librarian for this year. I'm going to go ahead and we're going to sit down for an hour and go through your vita. And we're going to see what you wrote and what's missing and everything else. And we're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about your field. And then I'm going to go and I'm going to spend some time looking for resources and materials. I'm going to come back and say, is this right? Is that right? Does this make sense? And then I'm going to put that packet together and you're going to go up for tenure. Now, here's the best part of this plan. If they get tenure, you are the greatest person on the face of the earth. We're talking chocolate and roses for days. And if they don't, they have to leave before they can even badmouth you. Huh? Right? So this idea, though, that, you know, here's a real need. Let's get into that need. This is a person. Someone coming up for tenure is a person at their most aspirational. They are making an argument that their dreams rest in their future. And what do we do? Oh, you don't know how to search this database? You don't know how to search that database? Why aren't we there helping them fulfill that dream and making that happen? That's going to build a bond way beyond what we can do in terms of, oh, this is how you search that. Oh, here's a database to look at. Now, the real place that this shows up, the real potential problem with the deficit model, taken to extremes, comes in the education bubble. Has everyone heard this phrase recently? Interactive portion again, sorry. No? Oh, do a search. And I don't, it doesn't, bing it. Sorry, Google hasn't become a commodity at all. Anyway, I go back to Alta Vista, damn it. And anyway, the education bubble goes like this. Everyone remember, you probably heard the phrase the housing bubble. You might have been around 2008, life went to hell, that whole thing. The housing bubble means that money artificially zooms into a market, builds up speculation, drives up costs. Everyone feels that they're going to get at the top of the market. Really, it's a sort of interesting pyramid build. And then something happens, and the market collapses on itself. So we go in, we buy lots of real estate. We're going to flip it. Lots of people are going to buy my houses. Suddenly, we realize that the people buying your house is because they bought another house, and they need to sell your house and their house. Right? And boom. Sorry about retirement. That's just not going to happen this decade. Now they're speculating that we're in the middle of an education bubble. Now, I know this comes as a radical shock to everyone who's ever had to pay a tuition bill, but it turns out higher education kind of expensive. And we're at Syracuse University. Anyway, the feeling here is that what's happened is education costs and tuition costs have been able to rise. This is the theory. And they don't rise simply because demand has increased, though it has. It's also risen because the capital has increased as well through student loans. In essence, the government is building up the cost. We can charge more because you're going to take out student loans. So, yeah, sure, you're going to be impoverished and go bankrupt in 10 years, but you're alumni then. We don't care. So the point is, we've made really easy access to money, which drives up the cost of education. And what's going to happen at some point is someone's going to realize, one, we've run out of money. Anyone seen a deficit recently? And two, it's not worth it.
right?
That suddenly people go, you know, I really don't want to go into debt for that. Right? I really don't want to go spend that money. I'm really willing to do without. Or business says, you're not doing what I need. I needed this person. You didn't do that person. I'm not going to subsidize and spend. Now, the education bubble bursts. Here, I want to give you three scenarios of it bursting. This is the upper before the kegger. The well runs dry. That in essence what happens is the federal government gets serious about deficit reduction. They radically decrease education price, education subsidies, because, you know, defense isn't going to go down. And so the well runs dry. Now, you're Harvard, you're Princeton, you're Cornell, you're fine. You're Syracuse, you're Geneseo, you're Clarkson. Your endowment's not looking as healthy as it used to. And suddenly you go, we just can't stay in business. No one's given us that money. We can't survive. We've now built dorms. We've now built stadiums. We've now built excellent football programs. We've now gotten that star 300,000 a year physicist who writes two papers in a century, but they're seminal. And suddenly, boom, it goes away. The well runs dry. We begin to look at school closures like crazy. Scenario number one, happy, happy times. Scenario number two, disruptive change. We've already felt a disruptive change. Phoenix, Capella, the for-profit universities that would come in and find the failing and bankrupting school with national accreditation, buy them, build people a direct mechanism to get federal funding and student loans, and they built up and became massive. And what was it? I mean, it was, let's face it, it was like the housing bubble. They took people who couldn't get into other universities, and they took them, and they took the federal loans that went with them, not necessarily caring if they succeeded or not. And they grew so big, it hurt. Now, I say this to people, and they go, well, colleges are never going away. When the federal government got serious about for-profit universities, in 1 year, the enrollment in for-profit universities in this country, in 1 year, dipped 30% in 1 year. Is your university, your college, ready to handle a 30% decrease in admissions tomorrow? Because that's what could potentially happen. Disruptive change. We now have people who are running contests where they will give out, was it $100,000 for people not to go to college but to start a business? Or is it $20,000? It was on 60 Minutes a while ago. But I mean, they basically said, it's not worth it. Here's a bunch of money. Go start a business. Right? Khan Academy says, oh, we can do it all in videos and 2-minute-long videos and all this other stuff. Microsoft, Apple. Apple is building Apple University, where they are going to prepare their own computer engineers, their own management people. They're going to create their own degree programs. We've already seen this in the technology field. Oh, don't go to college. Go get Microsoft certified. Go get Cisco certification. Go get all these other alternative certifications. What happens when people look at us as the dinosaurs? Not that they're looking at us as the very spry individuals right now. But those, I'm going to say, are a little out of our control. Not unlikely, not impossible, but frankly, things that we probably can't handle tonight. I want to give you a third scenario that to me is much more scary. And it's accountability run wild. And you're saying, accountability is a good thing, Dave. And I'm going to say, it can be, but there's such a thing as bad accountability. Bad accountability is what you can test. Where you begin to assess something, you begin to determine its value, you begin to see how much you support something, not by what it does, what it could be, what its potential is, but by what you can test. Now, you may have guessed there's a model we can look at for this. Our current K-12 example. Right? Now, this has gone beyond the us complaining about high schools not teaching kids how to write. Which, by the way, I was talking to a middle school teacher the other day who said, those elementary school kids, the teachers don't teach them how to write. I mean, I didn't. Somewhere there's a nursery school going, bottle time, your mother didn't teach you how to write in the womb. Anyway, this is an example where you look at things like No Child Left Behind, where you look at high-stakes testing, where you look at bubble scores, where you look at my son in fourth grade being tested on his reading ability, and that's shaping the curriculum because now instead of preparing him to be, I don't know, 9, we're teaching him how to take a test. And not only are we teaching him how to take a high-stakes test, but the teacher who's giving him the test, the results of that test screw him or her up. His or her job is on the line by how well my dipshit fourth grader takes a test. I love my fourth grader. Not really a rocket scientist. I mean, he throws rocks, but it's different. What this leads to is when you begin to talk about accrediting, keeping things accountable by what we can test, you begin to lead to things like balkanization of disciplines, standardization of curriculum. If you go into certain European countries and you want to get a degree in library science, there is a national curriculum in library science. The only thing that determines whether you go to this college or this college or this college is cost. Which one is cheaper? And that leads to colleges coming out with a cheapest is best solution. And that is not a real good quality promoter. Means testing of utility. We've already started this. Have you heard of this? When we go to create a degree program, we have to send it through the state. And to this, we've always had to do that. But now we have to show the labor market for the degree. If we cannot prove that these are hireable skills at certain levels that can sustain the alumni, they will not provide any support or financial support, anything in student loans. Now you say, Dave, maybe they should be able to get a job when you're done. I buy that. But if we begin to determine the only thing that colleges do by what our students can be hired by, it begins to limit what we do. And it begins to break it out. And so what was the first computer science degree? Right, where you said you had a computer science degree or a minor. In 19-whatever, not picking on you, Roy, the first person who got a computer science degree, it's like, well, what are you going to do? Well, there are going to be 7 in the world, according to IBM, so I hope I'm only 1 of 7 getting this degree. Right now, this is a good thing to get, right? And actually now, not so much, because now they're hiring people in other skills. Anyway, then we add to it this idea of splitting the discovery cycle and the teaching cycle. Universities for centuries have had an effective mechanism, and it goes like this. I know something, I learn something, I teach something. Right? So I am a physicist, I discover, I research, I find great physics. I can teach it to my students so they can discover great physics. But what we've seen already, I don't want to say this is coming, it's here, is when you split that up, I am a great researcher. Those are students. Don't bother me, right? I am a great researcher. I do not teach freshmen. I do not teach mere doctoral students, right? We've broken these apart. I only teach something. And we know that the problem comes in that we can hire brilliant, brilliant faculty, but when they can't teach, that breaks the mission. And we can hire brilliant, brilliant teachers, but when they're brilliant at teaching something that's 12 years old, that breaks the mission. Now notice, I didn't put it research and teaching cycle here, because we must be more expansive. At our school, we have what are called professors of practice. Professors of practice means they don't go sit there with the test tubes and all this other stuff. They actually do something. They actually come, right? Barbara Stripling, the new incoming ALA president, was director of the school libraries for the city of New York, is a professor of practice. We don't sit there and go, and she's second class, right? This idea that we're for a community college, oh, it doesn't apply to me, we don't do research, but we do hope that they keep up to date. I mean, I'm guessing that if you teach law enforcement, maybe something's changed in the last 20 years, I think. Right? So keeping that up to date, but if we then become, no, we have the curriculum. No, we have the standards. All you have to do is deliver it. You teach what? 2 and 2? You teach what? 3 and 3? No. You teach 7 hours a day. What is wrong with you people? Right? There's the curriculum. And we end up migrating from education to certification. This is from Jane Jacobs, wrote a great book on the dark ages ahead. And what she said is instead of preparing people to learn, we give them stamps of accreditation and send them out to get jobs. And when you do that, you limit innovations within a society. Now, I will tell you that in a world like this, library service gets real easy. It goes like this. A discipline determines a bunch of outcomes that people must know, drops it into the empty bucket that is their head, tests them, and if they pass, accredits them and sends them on their way. And so in this world, what a library does is they sit there and they say, okay, if those are the outcomes, here's the stuff. Really simple. The problem comes in that I don't know about you, but I didn't get into the library field because I wanted to fill slots. I didn't get into the library field because I was really good at finding predetermined categories and throwing things at it. I became a librarian because I was enhanced and I was enchanted with the idea of learning a scholarship of discovery. Even the old stereotype of a person who becomes a librarian to sit and read all day, like anyone has that time, at least they're reading all day. Right? It's like, I want to become a librarian so that I can do absolutely nothing. Now, we may have coworkers like that. I'm not going there. But the point of this is, you don't even need librarians to do this. I was called to the state, the Department of Education for the state. They said, there is a, let's call it a large for-profit institution that wants to start a master's degree in the state of New York, all online. I said, okay. And they said, they don't have a library. And our standards say they have to have a library. I said, okay. And they said, but what they're arguing is that they don't need a library because what they do is they give all the readings to the students as a packet for that course. And I went, not okay. Right? Because at a master's level, the idea is that people are mastering a field, they're discovering, they're finding enrichment, they're going beyond just what's read to discover new things. And if they don't have that utility and that resource, then they can't do it. Right? But that's what this model says. If you just need to know these four facts and these are the four articles, and if you read them, you get your check mark, then we're done. And if education goes into this world and you sit there and say, but David would never do that, how many people have seen the report cards discussion? How many people have seen the value? How many people have heard the Department of Education talking about outcome measures? How many? This is happening now. And you sit there and you say, but Dave, who cares? First of all, are you telling me assessment is bad? Because your colleague, Megan Oakley, would be very mad at you. No, assessment and accountability are good and important things, but bad is when they're a rigid system. Bad, rigid systems are bad. This is what education can do to you if it really sucks. The most important role of assessment is to know when things change. If we simply deliver these standards and such, we don't look at how they evolve, we have to say, you know what? It's time to retire our course on microcomputing. It's time to retire our course on Google searching. Soon. I meant Gopher, but Freud came in and gave me a slip. We need to think about when things change. We don't teach dialogue anymore. When did we give up dialogue? Should we have given up dialogue? All these kinds of, yes, we should have. The point of this is assessment is very good, but we have to understand that life is complex and so is good education. We cannot make things consumption ready. We cannot make things consumption friendly. We cannot make it so that they are empty buckets that we simply walk over to and pour knowledge into their head and send them on their way. If we're doing that for students at any level, whether they're undergraduates, whether they're getting an associate's degree, whether they're coming for a certificate, whether they're getting a doctorate, if we treat people as simply empty vessels that we can, like robots, send them through. This is the 21st century. Henry Ford even knew it was a limited model when he did it a century ago. We cannot become a production line understanding. And you sit there and you go, Dave, this is not my problem. This is not my problem. That's the provost's problem. That's the president's problem. This is your problem. This is what you do. When we talk about how students learn, how do they learn? We know how they learn. We know they learn from conversations. We know it's important that they have rich, interesting dialogues. In online study and in-person study, it's their classmates that are often more important than their professor. I have students here. They're my students. They will attest to this. Right? We know that it's teaching them a language, that much of education at the master's level and undergraduate level, it's just teaching them the language. It's teaching them what to say and how to understand it. They come to agreements. They argue. And as librarians, we help mediate that agreement. We teach them the Socratic method. I mean, goddamn Socrates, because it's ruined every faculty meeting ever. Right? Because someone says, you know, the sky's blue today, and instantly there is a faculty member that will go, prove it. It's like, screw you. Right? We've all been on that committee which did the same thing last year and the same year before, and it always has the same arguments. As librarians, we should be the brakes. We should be able to say, you know what? No, we're not going there again. Right? We know that it's memory. They need to remember what they learn over time. Archives, the idea of creating their culture, creating their personal cultures and understanding. And how do we as librarians do it? We do it by providing them access, but not just access to stuff, not to that collection. Access to conversations, access to interesting people, interesting ideas, new thoughts, new ways of thinking. We provide them basic knowledge and instruction on new approaches and new ways of doing things. We provide them with an environment that is not only safe, but stimulating and inspiring. When we look at libraries going through reconfigurations and construction projects, I'm sure all of you have lived through one or another, isn't it always amazing that it's the students that are the most resistant to change? I want a quiet place, I want it on the third floor, and I want my Carol, and don't bother me. Right? Because we always invite them to the meeting. They're not the keggers. Anyway, we need to worry about motivation. Why are they here? What do they do? That is what libraries and librarians are all about. We help them do this. We help them engage. And this is what a university must do. It's not just the provost's problems and the president's problems. It's our problem, too, because of our mission. Our mission as librarians is to improve society through facilitating knowledge creation in our communities. It is our problem because if a library is a great library, people love bad libraries. People love good libraries. People need great libraries. Great libraries are when you're closed and they actually force the doors open as they did in the California system. During finals, the University of California system, it was Davis? San Diego. They limited their hours and the students rioted to open the library again. That is a great library. That's right. Public insurrection is your metric of success. That's where we're going with this. A great university is the same way. A great university inspires conversations, inspires people to go beyond, inspires people not simply to consume, not simply to be good workers, not simply to be an audience to democracy, but to be the democracy, to be the market, to be what we understand. A great library, like a great university, is about challenging our conceptions. It's about going beyond. It's about bringing a whole new perspective to things. The faculty need us to show them the way. The provosts need us to model that. The library is no longer the heart of the place just because that's where the books are. The library is the circulatory system that keeps us alive by generating ideas and moving them from place to place to place. The library, the power of librarians, the number one asset of the library is in our ability to bring people together, to challenge them, and to have constructive conversations, to have arguments that last quite literally centuries that we maintain, that we think about beyond what's going to get us hired tomorrow. That's our goal. That's our challenge. That's what a great library is. A great library are the people sitting here inspired to make the world a better place. Thank you very much.